1967, we awoke. Awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you, good citizens, to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose, and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Welcome to the Eternal Village Cast, a program of conversations with those who created, those who've contributed to the canon, and those who cherish the brilliant and influential program, The Prisoner. Your attention, please. We invite all members of the Eternal Village's Literary Society to convene for a very special conversation on the art and science of the creative process. Good people, the Eternal Village is enchanted to share a conversation with the industrious and ingenious writer, story editor, and author of Miss Freedom, Mr. Andrew Cartmell.
Andrew, thank you so very much for joining us today. Reaching across this giant, this will be fantastic. I'm so excited to hear about your life as a writer, the work you've done, this breadth of creativity you've given the world, and of course, touching on that favored novel, Miss Freedom. May I start with probably the two scariest questions, which both sides of the coin.
I ain't afraid of no questions.
Good. What is the greatest, best, most wonderful part in today's world of being a creative and being a writer? What is that?
Well, you sort of narrowed that down for me helpfully, because a writer is what I am. I can't speak to other creative pursuits. I've done a little bit of directing, but that's about the only other thing that I've done. The greatest thing about being a writer is, this has been very much uppermost in my mind recently, because I've been following the news cycle in the UK, where there's, on the BBC, they have a lot of interesting documentaries. And one of these current affairs type documentaries is about how over 2/3 of people in the UK hate their job, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it just, what it brought home to me is, I love my job. In a way, it's not even a job, it's more of a calling. I love writing, you know? And I always have. And I feel that this is such a blessing compared to, there's people out there who've never worked out what they want to do with their lives. I had an ex-girlfriend, and that was her curse. She could never work out what she wanted to be or to do. I'd never had that. Ever since I learned to read, I've wanted to be a writer. And the fact that, thank the Lord, I'm now actually in a position where I can more or less earn a living by doing that. It's such a privilege to actually do what you love and be able to have that as your job. That's, you know, it's unbelievably good. So that's what being a creative means to me. It means that my life is content in a way that obviously so many people's isn't.
So then we have the opposite side of the coin. Andrew, in today's world, in the digital environment, what would you say are the greatest challenges, frustrations, or pains of being an author today?
Well, that's very interesting, because a few years ago, my answer would have been very clear-cut. Now, I would have been apprehensive about ebooks and other digital, I can't even say the word, other digital media eroding the writer's ability to earn a living, in the same way that it's very dramatically virtually destroyed the musician's ability to earn a living. The old model of selling LPs and then CDs is just gone, as I'm sure you know. Yeah. And that's because of the digital technology that's come in with sound files and the ability to share them. And there was a fear that ebooks might do something similar, but that has gone away, because it turns out that although people do read ebooks and they're very handy and people do like them, people also love physical books, and they're not about to give them up any time in a hurry. Mm-hmm. So what was seemed to be for a while shaping up to be a potentially huge negative is not a problem at all. Indeed, ebooks are a very useful additional income stream for the writer. So the world of new technology, the new today's world, as you framed it in the question, hasn't yet, you know, fingers crossed, touch wood, hasn't yet done anything to damage or to make unpleasant the life of a writer in any way that it, you know, in any new way. Mm-hmm. There are some worries on the horizon. For instance, in Britain, we've got a party called the Green Party, who normally I would embrace because, you know, they obviously have very sound values in terms of trying to protect the environment and the ecology and plenty of other very positive forward-thinking policies. But apparently, and I just learned this, is that they're also opposed to copyright. They think that everything should be free, which, you know, speak to any creative artist, and that's just infuriatingly stupid, because we work and we need to get paid for our work, and copyright is the means by which we can do that. And as I said just now, musicians are suffering terribly, but that's not an inherent problem. That the problem of that is that the way that people listen to music now is through applications like Spotify, and those streaming services just aren't paying a decent royalty to the musicians when they could. So this has sort of broadened out your question beyond just what is happening with writers in the modern world, but that's because it's, I think, the musicians who really are at the sharp end. And I have a great, I'm not a musician myself, but I have a deep and passionate love of music, and I write about it a great deal. So that's something that I think about a lot.
I appreciate that, both perspectives. The other question, just to go a little deeper into the side of the profession, is there both a positive and a negative of something that is oftentimes a very private work? Meaning, if you worked at a newspaper, yes, there you are in the bullpen with all the other authors, all the other writers. But I'm also betting that there's a certain amount of solace or solitude when you're creating these amazing graphic novels and books. Does that ever come into a play of either both joy and sometimes the frustration of a career?
Well, the thing I love about writing is that there's relatively little interference. I mean, when you're working in, I always hated working in an office. And to be honest, I've always hated having a boss, because I've never met anybody who I felt was in a position that they should be giving me orders, because I never felt I met anybody who was bright enough or talented enough to, you know, to accord them that privilege. So you don't have a boss as such, but you do have people that you're answerable. Most importantly, as a writer, you're answerable to the people who read your stuff, because if they don't like it and they won't buy it, then that's that. But in a more conventional sense, say you're writing novels, then the person you have to learn to work with is your editor, and you've got to have a good relationship with your editor. But, you know, that's it, once you do find an editor like that, then it's all pretty clear sailing. You don't really have to deal with much in the way of office politics. I mean, you might have to have, you know, develop proper relationships with the designers who are going to do your cover and the publicity people who are going to promote your book. But it's all coming from a place of strength, in the sense that your book is there, that it's your own work, and everybody acknowledges that it's your own work. Whereas when you're in an office, how much ownership do you have of any of the projects that you're working on? So that's one thing. But I mean, that's just talking about life as a novelist. You're asking about what the isolation is like. What's it like to collaborate as opposed to working on your own? The wonderful thing about writing is basically it is done solo. It's done in your head and on the keyboard as you type away. But then you have to hand it over to other people, and it has to have an effect on them. But I don't just work as a novelist. I work, as you mentioned, as a writer of comic books or graphic novels. And that's a wonderful collaboration. I mean, I both collaborate on the writing side with a writing partner, Ben Aronovich, but also with the guy who draws the comics, who's called Lee Sullivan. And there's this wonderful thrill attached to writing comics, in that you see your words literally made flesh, in the sense that they're turned into visuals. So that's a particular thrill. Now, there are difficulties if you work with an artist and they're not doing a great job, and we've had that too. But luckily, Lee Sullivan, who's the backbone of the Rivers of London comics, he's fantastic. I also write plays, stage plays, and that really begins to move us out of the realm of the isolated writer and into the realm of collaboration. Because for a start, you need a director, you need a producer, but also, and most obviously, you need actors. And I've been sitting in rehearsal rooms in London, working with a team of fantastic actors, five actors, a director and a producer, to put together a play in preparation for a potential run in London. And, you know, as much as I love being the lone wolf and doing my writing on my own, I also love this second phase and third phase in which you step out of that isolation and you actually work with collaborators who are absolutely essential to the process. Because I, on the one hand, as I said, I don't like working in offices. I don't like taking orders from anybody, but I am a very sociable creature. I do like interacting with people, especially when it's my work, my writing that they're all working on. It's such a fantastic thrill. And it, you know, I suppose it is a bit of an ego trip, but on the other hand, I work really hard to make the play or the book or the comic the best I can. So I feel that I'm putting in the hard work and then I'm earning the rewards that these other people are willing, you know, they like my material enough to put their creative energy into it. And that's when it gets really exciting. And obviously in film and television, it's the same thing, but on an even bigger canvas, because you have this huge team who are involved in putting, when we used to do Doctor Who, it's not just the actors, obviously it's the people who do the lighting, who use the cameras, who record the sound, who do the video effects, it goes on and on. There's this enormous team trying to bring into reality what used to exist just in your mind. It really is a thrill.
In there are so many amazing seeds of conversation. The idea of, if it doesn't start on the page or in your mind's eye, then you're not going to have a movie, a TV show, or a play. But again, you're right, it is a collaboration because one can't do all those parts. I want to take the audience back just one step to the idea of your discussion of working in an office with the people. A while ago, you wrote what looks to be, by the opinions of those who've read it, a very fascinating book titled Script Doctor, The Inside Story of Doctor Who. Tell us a bit about how that may have either solidified or created this attitude. Was that a life-altering experience of having to work in such a large mechanism as the BBC and the Doctor Who world?
It was life-altering, and it was great. It was the greatest opportunity of my career to date. It was not an office job, not in the conventional sense, because I had my own little office, and just down the corridor was the producer's office, and then we would have teams, production teams roll in to do individual stories, and then they'd open up offices. So nobody would recognize, nobody who has a conventional day-to-day office job would recognize that as being the same system that they work under. Mm-hmm. But the thing about Script Doctor, which is my memoir about working on the show, the only reason I could write that book is by great good fortune, I kept a diary in those days. And I was able to reconstruct what it was actually like working on the show and give a genuine flavor of creating a television program, creating Doctor Who at that time and in that place. So I'm very proud because it's kind of a time capsule. And although Doctor Who, you know, Doctor Who fans will find that it has a built-in appeal, anybody who's wants to know what it was like making a TV show at the BBC in the 1980s would find it, find that there's a lot of fascinating material there. I mean, I do too when I go back and look at it, because it brings to life another world, and a world that is now gone.
And ripe for the perfect opportunity, especially with the idea of Doctor Who fans and nostalgia. So what we need now is to find some British television producer who wants to make that into a miniseries. That seems to be the next great opportunity right there.
Well, I don't think that the Script Doctor could really sustain a miniseries. Because it doesn't have any kind of dramatic arc except for that of making the TV show. Mm-hmm. As you might know, that there was a TV movie called Adventures in Time and Space, which was about the making of the first Doctor Who, about the early days of Doctor Who. And I suppose you can fashion that sort of thing into TV drama, but yeah. I would much rather create a work of fiction and put it to that end rather than trying to put a saddle on a sow, as you might say, by trying to turn Script Doctor into a TV series. Although I must admit, it's an exciting idea, which I haven't heard before, Carl, so good for you.
Okay.
Anybody who's read script doctor will know that I talk about my love of other television shows in it, including, let's not forget, The Prisoner.
Absolutely. Now, in this cornucopia of creations you've given the world, you have a lot of work in the theme of Doctor Who. You also have more recent creations, the theme of The Vinyl Detectives and The Rivers of London. In all of those endeavors, tell me this. Do you have a standard process that you use when creating a new character and a new theme, that you start with something like index cards to lay out the chapters, or do you jump to the twist? How do you write?
When I first began writing, I just sort of like bulled forward, just started writing and just kept writing. This would have been novels, and I sort of blundered forward, but I rapidly learned that's not the way to do it. Not least because if you don't know where you're going and you're just writing thousands and thousands of words, you'll end up inevitably almost writing thousands of words that need to be cut.
Right.
Because at the moment, I'm writing extremely quickly on the fourth final detective novel. But the reason I like today, I wrote 3,500 words, which is a lot. There's a novelist called Graham Greene, a wonderful novelist. And he used to write 500 words a day. Now, 500 words a day is a very good rate. Because in the course of a year, if you do that consistently every day, that's two novels a year, two full-length books a year. So when I do 3,500 words, that's a lot. That's like a week's worth of Graham Greenery.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I can write that much stuff is I'm working on a structure that I've already created. I laid down the foundations of this novel quite a while ago, and I had a very clear idea of the layout of the book, where it's going, the main plot points and so on. So that's what I'm saying, is that you can write quickly and write large volumes, providing you've done that groundwork. And I just learned the hard way that you do have to do that groundwork, by which I mean you need an outline. You're talking about index cards. I do something somewhat similar. I open up a folder on the screen on my computer, and I put a bunch of Word files into the folder side by side, almost like those index cards you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they represent the chapters of the book. And I give each chapter a distinctive title so that it kind of summarizes what is happening in that chapter. So I've got about 30 chapters. That's the standard number for one of my novels, about 3,000 words a chapter. So I've got these 30 word files with their little titles, which are a bit like index cards. And I might move them around. I think, oh, hang on, that chapter should go back earlier, and I move them around like that. And then eventually I start filling up those word files with the necessary words to fill each chapter. So I do kind of use that routine. But also, you mentioned character when you were asking about my process. And it's true for me, and it's certainly very true for some other writers, that the process is character-led. Because once you've got an interesting character who's come to life in your mind, they do begin to write the story for you, because their behavior dictates the plot. And if you come up with a really interesting, really eccentric, vivid character, they'll go off in all sorts of fascinating and often funny directions, which are really valuable, because they're doing things that if you just sat down and worked out the plot rationally, you might never even have dreamt up.
Mm-hmm.
So I do know there are writers out there, including screenwriters, who just create a vivid character and let them loose and see what happens. I'm, as I've sort of been indicating, I'm a little more organized than that. I would be inclined to work to a more laid out and strict outline than that. But I do feel that there's also considerable scope for improvisation. And the way you achieve that is by creating interesting characters and putting them in just the rough outline of the story and seeing what develops from there.
When creating, for example, in the two contemporary series, The Rivers of London and The Vinyl Detective, are these something that you put yourself on a very specific timeline, meaning that the new creation must begin on this day and end on this day, or do you grant yourself an elasticity of when sometimes ideas come to you?
Well, I'm trying to remember the name of the writer who pointed this out, but the fact of the matter is, if you understand why people want to sit around and wait for inspiration because they want the best possible idea. So I completely get that. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, if you urgently need to come up with a great idea, it's much more likely to come than if you're just sitting there twiddling your thumbs. I mean, a lot of writers have come to this conclusion. For instance, Stephen King's written a very good book on writing, and one of his stipulations is that you actually set aside a certain time every day, and preferably a place like an office, where you, a time and a place where you're going to do your writing. And he said, just turn up for that every day. And even if you can't think of anything, just sit there for the allotted number of hours. And he says, eventually, the inspiration will start to turn up. The ideas will start to turn up. And, you know, he's not alone in that. I remember Randy Newman, the songwriter, saying the same thing. He keeps office hours. He just sits there and waits for stuff to happen. You know, you sit at the keyboard, the piano keyboard, if you happen to be a musician, or the keyboard on your computer, if you're writing novels. And what I'm saying is that you have to meet inspiration halfway. You have to sit there and try.
Right.
I'm quite disciplined in that I will sit down and make myself write a certain number of words, but I have quite a loose structure. Like, for instance, now that I'm really getting in to the final stages of developing this novel, I don't sit down every morning at 9 o'clock. Sometimes I do, but you know, I will also still be up at midnight writing. I don't have any fixed pattern. I do as much as I can whenever I can, but that's because it's sort of reached the point on this book where it's really starting to pop. Like, you know, when you have popcorn and it starts pinging in the pan, things are really starting to happen. And so it's quite an exciting part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back and correlate two things. So I in Seattle am very blessed to work with a group of, for lack of a better word, creatives, people who do performance art. And you, in working now with the people in London, do you ever find that the challenge as an artist is that you see in your mind's eye this enormous panorama, everything you'd like to give, but then it's intersected by two factors, time and money. And so suddenly you have to shrink that panorama. And what I find the artist mind has a tendency to do is look so much at what was left off the screen and yet not giving themselves enough credit for all the amazing things that becomes the page or the stage or the screen. Do you feel any of the same ways about that challenge?
You mentioned screen, which is where this comes in. If you're working on a TV show or a movie, what you've described is very often the case. But when you're working on a novel, I would say it's never the case because there are no budgetary constraints. There aren't any really real constraints of time or money. If you're working on a comic book, there are no constraints of budget. There are time constraints because you're trying to hit a monthly publication deadline in a lot of cases. And, you know, things can go wrong. Like there might be a problem with the guy who's doing the coloring or whatever. But by and large, that's not a budgetary concern. You don't have to scale back your ambitions for what the story you wanted to tell. So that never enters into that. For a play, a stage play, which is on my mind because I'm working on one at the moment, you have to be aware of the realities of putting on a play. And I've written quite a few stage plays. So for instance, the plays that I write these days tend to have one set because that's really simple. Try and have all the action in one set. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are vast, ambitious, complex plays by people like Peter Schaffer, things like Amadeus, say, or Equus, which involve tremendous resources and forces on the stage, and they're very elaborate. And that works, but it also is great just to keep things scaled down and simple. So I try and keep the number of actors required down. I try and keep the number of sets down. In this case, recently I've been writing plays with only one set. And I also try and be aware of the realities of staging a play. And this is not so much to do with money, but it is to do with time and space. So for instance, in the play that I've just been describing that we've been working on, there's a scene in which two of the actresses have to go out and change. And in fact, three actors have to go out and do an elaborate costume change. So I put one of the actors who didn't have to do that, and I found a way of keeping him on stage without anybody else. It just having a telephone call, and he's doing some sort of slapstick comedy. The whole point about that scene is it gives a chance for the other guys to get out of there and change their costumes. So you have to think about things like that, and it becomes second nature to you. Mm-hmm. But there aren't the kind of budgetary constraints, those problems with time or money that you're describing. Those really are the precinct, I'd say, of TV and movies. And when I was working on Doctor Who, there was always a problem with a lack of time and lack of money. But it didn't tend to manifest itself in the sense that there were wonderful scenes that we didn't do. It was more like there was wonderful scenes that we tried to do and we blew it because the special effects were terrible, or we didn't have time to do another take, things like that. So that can be quite heartbreaking.
Now, if we, again, taking what you said about a character can drive the story, interesting, almost like parent to child or child to parent relationship. Tell us a little bit about how, in this mosaic of creativity, where did the inspiration or the opportunity arise from to write a book about number six and life in the village and the adventures of that entire world? How did that come into your hands or into your thoughts?
Well, I was lucky enough to encounter a publisher called Matteo Latozza of Powers Books, mm-hmm. In Los Angeles, who had the license to do a series of original Prisoner novels. And he's a tremendously nice, long-suffering guy, because, you know, being a publisher is not the easiest gig in the world. Mm-hmm. And Matteo allowed me the opportunity to do a Prisoner book. And since I'd left Doctor Who, the TV show, I'd done a bunch of what we'll call spin-off novels. Like, I'd written a grand total of four Doctor Who novels of varying kinds. I'd also written books for other characters who I hadn't created. There's a comic strip character called Judge Dredd in the UK. I wrote a Judge Dredd book. I wrote one about a character called Strontium Dog, who used to appear in the same magazine, same comic as Judge Dredd, called 2000 AD. So mm-hmm. I'd written a bunch of stuff for characters that I hadn't created myself. But none of those I'd always done the best possible job, but none of those had been a particular turn on. Because although I'd worked as a script editor on Doctor Who and I respected the show and I liked it, I'd never been a Doctor Who fan. Like, when I was a kid, I didn't race home to see Doctor Who. And I'd never been a huge Judge Dredd or Strontium Dog fan, but I had been a Prisoner fan. I'd even joined this fan club called Six of One in the UK, mm-hmm. Which is something almost unheard of for me. I'm not really a fan club kind of guy, but they had these great things, like you could buy a copy of the soundtrack LP. They did some copies, they printed copies of some of the scripts. I think they got into trouble for that. They had a fanzine. And the reason I was involved with that is because I loved that show. I did see some episodes when it was first broadcast, when I was living in Canada. And then there was, when I moved to the UK, there was a repeat on a station called Channel 4 where they repeated the whole series. And that was when I really, really realized how great it was, what a fantastic show it was. And so when the opportunity to do a novel for The Prisoner came along, I was very interested, because here was a show that was actually beloved of me. Mm-hmm. And on top of which, The Prisoner is falls in that class of 1960s spy dramas, which really got kickstarted by the James Bond movies, but there were other very interesting entries. The spy fiction craze of the 1960s really was kickstarted by the James Bond movies. The James Bond novels had been very popular, but nothing compared to what would happen when, in 1963, they made a movie out of Dr. No.
Right.
But the spy craze wasn't just focused on James Bond. At around about the same time, there was also John le Carré's Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which was a big bestseller and turned into a very interesting movie. There were the Len Dayton spy novels, like The Ypres File, Funeral in Berlin, Billion Dollar Brain. And but beyond that, there was a really terrific movie called The Quiller Memorandum, which was based on an excellent book called The Berlin Memorandum by Adam Hall. So the genre of spy fiction was really kind of jumping in the 60s. And The Prisoner came in. I mean, there were TV shows in this genre too. In Britain, there's one called Callan. In fact, there's a lot of these interesting spy dramas. Danger Man. Danger Man is particularly interesting, of course, because it features Patrick McGoohan. And when he became fed up with doing his 60s spy series, he kind of flipped it on its head and created The Prisoner, which was in many ways a deconstruction of the whole spy fiction genre. So what I'm saying rather long-windedly is that I loved all this stuff. So it wasn't just a case of loving The Prisoner, but I realized if I was going to do a prisoner novel, I would effectively be writing in that genre of the great 60s spy novel, the kind of stuff by Le Carré, Fleming, Dayton, and particularly Adam Hall, because I love those Quiller books. Mm-hmm. So that I had those very much in mind when I sat down to write Miss Freedom. So it was, to me, it was a two for one. I got to write this TV series, a franchise that I loved, The Prisoner, but also I got to write in the form of a classic 60s spy novel, and that really turned me on. And of all the books I've written, which are based on characters I haven't created, The Prisoner, Miss Freedom, is really the only one for which I have unqualified love.
That, well, I share the love, and I will tell in anecdote form that when, as I guess if you will say, when the internet became the teenager that grew into a child, between 2000 and 2010, websites would pop up and sometimes real, sometimes not. But discovering Pews Media and finding those books at the time was feeding a hunger for more, please, more, please. And I remember just this anxiety of going and checking and saying, well, Miss Freedom will be out. When it will be out? It'll be out. When will be out? And the copy that I obtained has your signature in it. And it was a thrill because it was one that was ordered immediately when it was published.
Well, thank you so much for that, Carl. Can I just say you're very lucky, because I think there was only about 100 copies of that edition published. It's a very rare book you've got there. Yeah. So congratulations.
And because it's rare, it's been shared with a few friends who love it as well. It'll also be on display in this memorabilia collection in September. But the interesting thing about fandoms...
For many years, that book has been out of print and has become extremely rare. But that, if you're interested in getting a copy of Miss Freedom, it is back in print now.
Oh, good.
It's available in print on demand. It's a very handsome edition. So if you just go to Amazon, look up Miss Freedom Andrew Cartmell or Miss Freedom the Prisoner, you should be able to find it and get a copy. So, and it's only very recently I was able to say this again, after years of the book being unavailable, people approaching me and asking me how they could get a copy. So that, it's really nice that it's back.
Yeah, it is. And again, as this group of devotees grow, they all are hungry to have things that expand this universe. Now, on a related topic, recently I made a social media post about the 2009 Prisoner remake. Looking back in hindsight and sharing some opinions about it, and the fervor, oh my God, the absolute vitriolic fervor by some people as to whether they liked or disliked it was probably 10 times greater than what you'd find in the Balkans around 2000 after the war. Did you find from Prisoner fans any kind of extremely strong, visceral, both praise or criticism because you dared to write in their favorite thing, the genre?
No, not really, because I did go to a couple of Prisoner conventions. People were just pleased to see another Prisoner item out there.
Yes.
And also, I think if they took the trouble to read the book, they would have found that I was very true to the spirit of the show, I believe. So I didn't do anything radical or disrespectful with it. So, and also, it was quite a handsome publication. So people were just pleased to have this thing in their hand that was another Prisoner item which they could add to their collection, by and large. I certainly didn't get any of this sort of schismatic anger that you're talking about, but that's because, as I say, I hewed very close to the standard form of the show. Whereas the Prisoner remake that you mentioned, I mean, it was kind of interesting, but I don't think you can take the prisoner and set it somewhere else. I think you've got to be in a village that looks like the village. I know that they tried to, I think, what was it, in Botswana or somewhere that they shot it?
Namibia,
thank you. Yeah, but I don't think that it then ceases to be the prisoner. I think you have to go down to Wales and shoot it in that location, because that's such a part of the show. It's part of the character of the show. And once you change those parameters, you're making something, but it really isn't the prisoner anymore, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, when the process began for writing that beautiful novel, again, drawing back to the processes you've talked about being a writer, did you give yourself the same structures, the same timeline? Was it a little bit more of a new process because it was a character you cherished? How did that writing experience work compared to others you'd done?
Well, the main thing that dictated my approach to that was, again, to go back to the 60s spy novel, I was writing along the template of a fast-moving espionage thriller of those days, which was heavily fact-based in the sense that if I was talking about military hardware, like there's a helicopter, and I did a lot of research on what the helicopter actually would have been, and so on. So those were the kind of dictates that influenced my approach to the novel, and that perhaps made it different from from the other ones I'd written.
Got it. Now, when you mentioned seeing the show as a youth and then seeing the show later on Channel 4, the fun thing for those of us who are in a certain age group is we always talk about how we watch television more intently, possibly, than people today, because in that time...
You knew it was ephemeral. Back in the day, we didn't even have video recorders, so you had to
pay attention.
And that was it.
Yeah. When you had this opportunity come along to be able to create the story, did you, with new media, did you get a hold of the DVDs? Did you get a hold of maybe some of the script books?
No, it was even better than that, because I don't think in America you have the term part work, but let me explain what that is. Sometimes to exploit a product like, say, Star Trek, in the UK, and I think in the States too, they'll do this thing that they'll publish a magazine, and like every Doctor Who story, every Star Trek story, they'll have a magazine which describes the making of it, and then you get a DVD that accompanies that. Mm-hmm. So you could do that with Game of Thrones. But anyway, there was a just around this time, there was a prisoner part work, excuse me, which in other words was a magazine that would appear, and every episode of the show had a magazine tie-in with it, which had photos from the show and discussion about the production, and they had the relevant DVD attached. So the DVDs weren't of great importance to me, because I already had a box set for the show, but these magazines were great because they had things like, they had floor plans, diagrams, layouts, details about like that helicopter, which was an Alouette that I mentioned. So I've still got that prisoner collection of magazines upstairs. They usually give you a handsome binder for you to collect the magazines into, and that was an invaluable resource. I found that tremendously useful when I was researching this. And I watched the show too, but mostly I drew on that.
That's funny, the folding in of a universe, because glimpse behind the scenes. Today, this after having the joy of talking with you, I'm going to meet with our audio editor, who is going to take all the elements of our latest episode, seam them together so we can publish it. And that includes a conversation with a gentleman named Tim Palgett. Tim was one of the contributors to exactly what you're discussing, the prisoner fact files. Tim is the general.
Oh, that was what it's called. Yes. Great. Well, do say thank you to him, because I love that.
Because Tim is the gentleman who wrote the, for lack of a better word, it's the Inside the Village book. It's the technical manual that hopefully every prisoner fan has, that shows those amazing schematics of inside number two and lair and inside the house. So it's funny how, again, as he mentioned in that interview that'll come out next week, that was so instrumental for him to take his ideas, find them published, and then become a book. And then meanwhile, there you are reading his creative work to lend itself to this beautiful novel you created.
To create my own book, it's fantastic. But I really value and appreciate people who do the hard work of creating those factual background material, which gives us creatives the fuel to run on.
Yeah. So now the question that I've wanted to ask ever since I closed the last page of that book.
Oh, yeah.
Is there any possibility that in the scope of work you have, there might be another prisoner novel coming sometime in the future?
Well, I really enjoyed doing that one, but I think not, because I think Matteo, the publisher at Powers Press, I think he still does have the license, but I'm not sure for how much longer. And although I deeply love that book, I think I got that one right. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to take the chance on doing another one and getting it wrong. So for all those reasons, plus I've reached a point now where I hope to just write my own original stuff and not have to write any more novels based on characters created by other people. Because although I learned a great deal from doing that, and I did have some fun and made some money, and in the case of Miss Freedom, fashioned something of which I will always be proud, I think I've kind of moved on from there, which no disrespect to anybody, but there comes a point in your life when you're a creative artist, when you feel that you have to do your own work and not adhere to somebody else's creation. Having said that, the comics I write are based, like I'm writing Doctor Who comics and I'm writing these Rivers of London comics, mm-hmm. based on a series of novels written by my friend Ben Aronovich. But that's a different thing. I don't mind doing that at all. But even there, I would like to branch out and do more of my own original stuff.
Right. And that really respects what you said about having the freedom and the independence to work without anyone guiding, nudging, cajoling your work. So take us then into this creation of yours about the Vinyl Detectives. I'm very curious about where that scene, that idea came from. Okay. Tell us a little bit.
Vinyl Detective Singular, and it came about, this all ties in with what I was just mentioning before, my friend Ben Aronovich.
Yeah.
Okay, a bit of background. I script edited the TV show Doctor Who. I was... And we'll just wait. There's a plane going overhead. I don't know if that's going to be... Okay, so it's gone. So I worked as script editor on a TV show called Doctor Who, which we've mentioned. Effectively, in those days, in the BBC, the role of script editor was close to what you would now call a showrunner. I had an enormous scope and freedom in terms of putting the show together. What I'm saying is that I led the writing team. And one of the writers I discovered... certainly the one who was most talented and suited to writing Doctor Who was a guy called Ben Aronovich. And we had a great time working together. We were on the same wavelength and we really respected each other as creatives. And I stayed in touch with Ben. And whenever I worked on another TV show, I always made a point of hiring Ben. And then both of our careers kind of ended up on the beach, which is a term that they have in the Navy for when you lose your ship and you're just sitting around and you haven't got a mission anymore. So we had lost our TV shows and we were out of the loop. And there's a few years when we couldn't get arrested. And Ben decided that if he couldn't get any work in television, he was going to write a novel. And he did. He wrote a novel called Rivers of London, and it was a big bestseller. And it's become part of a hugely best-selling series, millions of books in print now, the Rivers of London series. And they're about the Metropolitan Police in London dealing with the supernatural. So I seem to be talking a lot about Ben's books here, but the point of that was Ben went from being broke and penniless to being a big successful writer. And I said to him, I'd like to do that too, Ben. What is the trick? And he said, the crucial thing is that you write about what you really love. Like, don't kid yourself. Don't write about what you think the marketplace wants. Write about what you really genuinely love. And in Ben's case, that meant London. London, mm-hmm. with all its history and topography and geography. So I thought, well, you know what I really love, to be honest, is that I love collecting records, listening to vinyl. I love listening to jazz. I love going around to thrift stores and swap meets. We would call those charity shops and boot fairs in England, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And junk shops and looking through crates of old records and occasionally finding a treasure. I mean, that got me excited. And of course, I also love crime fiction. So I thought, well, what about if I had a detective who's what they call a crate digger, a guy who's all secondhand records, you know, a record collector. A record collector turned sleuth. And that's where that began, out of my love for music and for vinyl and indeed murder mysteries. So I combined all that and I came up with A Vinyl Detective. And the first book was called Written in Dead Wax, which is a strange and evocative phrase. But if you ask any real vinyl nut, any record collector, they'll know what it means. It does have a very specific meaning. And it's fascinating. I do find the whole area of making records on vinyl a fascinating thing.
Now, as we talked about change in the marketplace, have you noticed in the last few years, because I personally have, I share your passion for the idea of fun record stores. Just recently was in Vancouver, BC, and visited a few. But they've lost a bit of their, if you will, novelty for me lately, because so much of what people find is the rare or unique finds just suddenly go up on someone's website or up on eBay. And when in the past, there was always this discovery aspect of it. Do you ever get a little frustrated that now what's ending up at those boot things or charity shops are just sort of the repetition of what you see over and over?
Well, no, because what you're saying is true, that, mm-hmm. that if you have a specialist record store, they will also have an online presence. And if they find a rare record, they're likely to try and auction it on eBay to maximize their reward and so on. But the kind of stores I'm talking about, which are like the thrift store, charity shop type thing, they're random. They're totally random.
Yeah.
And although they do try and get their act together and keep their eyes open for rare records so they can, you know, fair enough, maximize their profits, stuff slips through. You never know what you're going to find. And also these swap meets or boot fairs, as we call them, people just turn up with stuff and you never know. And that's the exciting thing. It's like, I mean, I used to love secondhand bookstores too, because you don't know what's going to be there. You just don't know what's going to turn up. And you can just find these gems. And the internet is both a blessing and a curse. It's a curse because people tend to sell things for top dollar and you don't find bargains. And if you're a thrifty guy like me, you love a bargain. But on the other hand, it means if you really want to find something, it's easier to find it out there. There's actually a means for tracking it down. So I kind of love that. And also, you're talking about record stores not being what they used to be. On the other hand, if you just dial back about 20 years, Carl, it looked like vinyl was going to die a death and CD was going to dominate. Well, of course, CD is dead in the water now, and vinyl is going from strength to strength with things like Record Store Day.
Yeah, and it seems as though every concert I go to now, the version that they have for sale is the vinyl, which I love, because it's not only a great version, but it's also visually much more appealing. It's larger.
Absolutely. You've got this 12-inch square picture frame where you have this gorgeous illustration, and that I was so heartbroken when CD came along, because it looked like that was gone, and now it's back with a vengeance. I'm so pleased. But vinyl is a thing of beauty. Even I mean, you find kids who buy vinyl who don't even have a record player, although it is easier and easier to buy record players now, and that's because it's just a beautiful object, and I'm down with that completely.
And I am culpable of that. I have a series of albums, including a variety of prisoner albums, including the one you mentioned, the one from years and years ago, published by Six of One. And no, of course I don't own a record player, but they still have extreme value for me because they are pieces of history. So now, not that this would ever happen, never would this happen, but if just by chance a great wind were blowing in your neighborhood and you had to run from your home and you had to gather only a few things in your arms, what are a few of the albums out of your collection, let's say the top three, that you couldn't leave that danger without carrying away with you? What would they be?
Well, I always answer this question by saying I would take my cat and my computer with me.
That's in one hand.
What record would I rescue? Well, I've just literally yesterday acquired a record I've been looking for years, which is called Eastern Sounds by Yusuf Lateef, which is a classic jazz album. Mm-hmm. And since you ask, This is the original Moodsville Green Label mono deep groove pressing, which won't mean anything to anybody except people who know about this record.
Yeah.
I might be sorely tempted to save that one because it's really good. There's a fantastic record called East Coasting by Charles Mingus. I would save the Blue Label Stereo Bethlehem copy of that, the American pressing, because it's fantastic. And you said a third one. Can I even think of a third one? It's...
Well, fair is fair. Isn't it the original soundtrack to Chitty Chitty Bang Bang? Wouldn't we all grab that and run with that? I mean,
well, it's funny you say that, because although I wouldn't save that, I probably would save a soundtrack. Because that was a couple of jazz albums. Let's just say, for the sake of the argument, the third one might be the soundtrack to Casino Royale by Burt Bacharach. Not only because it's a great recording of great music and quite rare, but also because it has a deep resonance for me, because it was one of the first records I ever owned when I was a kid. So there you go, Casino Royale by Bacharach, East Coasting by Mingus, and Eastern Sounds by Yusef Lateef.
That is, along with your cat and your computer, that is a wonderful way to escape danger to a new place. Now, as this year, which is flying by so fast, moves forward, what can people be expecting to see from you, to be able to purchase from you as your creativity goes out to the world? What more is going to be published under the banner of Andrew Cartmell?
Okay, so my third vinyl detective novel, which is called Victory Disc, was just published in May. The fourth novel, which I'm hard at work at now, called Flip Back, is published May next year. Between now and then, we've just had a new Rivers London graphic novel come out. Please do check it out.
Yes.
That's called Cry Fox, and that's in graphic novel form in the stores now. We're doing the 4-issue mini-series run of the next graphic novel as 4 monthly comics. That's called Waterweed, and I'm very proud of that. That's, I think, one of the best we've ever done. That'll be turned into a graphic novel probably around about Christmas time with a bit of luck. And I would also say, keep your eyes peeled for my play, Screwball, which is a screwball comedy, which we hope to have on in London in about a year's time.
That's fantastic. Wishing you all the best with every one of those endeavors and all the other things that come into your creative mind, and hoping that we get the chance to talk to you again to find out how they're all coming to fruition.
Thank you, Carl. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for being so professional about this. I'm not naming any names, but not all those podcasts out there are quite as professional.
My probation and my parole officer will be very happy to hear that. I appreciate it. Have a fantastic day.
Oh, and you might have heard that. That was the cat running in from outdoors to say she's got to be rescued first.
So true. The countdown to September 9 is passing quickly. Whether as a villager, a warder, or an observer, the Eternal Village has ways for everyone to take part in this year's very special program. All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village Cast. Please send your remarks care of info@theeternalvillage.org. Until our next program, be seeing you.